When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast. Calling former Greenpeace chief Patrick Moore a controversial environmentalist is enough to spark a controversy. Nobody's going to argue that Moore's not controversial, but a lot of people will loudly proclaim he's not an environmentalist. Moore told me he considers himself an environmentalist, but he's not a fan of environmentalism. He says environmentalism implies there's some sort of Bible or manifesto. If there is a Bible, Moore stands accused of breaking all sorts of commandments. In a piece for the National Post, Moore wrote, "I am variously called an eco-Judas, turncoat, green basher, green washer, corporate shill, flip-flopper, sellout, and finally, Darth Vader." Moore considers himself a man of science. I met Moore at his office in downtown Vancouver to find out why the former Green Peacer switched sides in so many of the Green Wars.
What is Green Spirit, and how did Green Spirit come about?
Well, Green Spirit came about 5 years after I left Greenpeace. When I left Greenpeace in 1986, and we could get into that if you wanted, but that's another question, I went and started a salmon farm at my family home at Winter Harbor on the northwest tip of Vancouver Island. Salmon farming was just in its infancy in British Columbia at that time. I met Brad and June Hope, and the other people who had just started it. And I had also, while I was in Greenpeace and considering doing something else for a change, I'd read a book on aquaculture by Elizabeth Mann Borghese, who is of the Borghese family of the Isle of Man, and she'd been working in the Law of the Sea process with the United Nations, and in her travels around the world had witnessed the emerging practice of marine aquaculture. Like, we've been doing freshwater aquaculture with carp in China, for example, for 3,000 years or more. But marine aquaculture, especially with fish, is a very recent phenomenon. Shellfish have been done for a long time, primarily oysters and mussels and clams. And now, though, we're also doing shrimp and prawns and lobsters. And in fish, we're doing a whole range of species of fish now, about 100 species of fish. But salmon has been the leader in this marine aquaculture revolution. And I realized that aquaculture was a logical next step, in the same way that we went from hunting and gathering on the land to farming of our food crops, going from pure exploitation of wild species of fish and shellfish to farming the sea, was a logical step for us to take with a growing population and the threat to the wild stocks that exist from overfishing. So I saw aquaculture as a sustainable development, and that was what I wanted to do. So I went into aquaculture. Well, that was fine until then. I just, you know, it wasn't long after I got into doing something that was going to be a family business and not involved with politics. Within a year or two, I was named the president of the BC Salmon Farmers Association. It was a fledgling group at the time with like maybe 20 members or something, but we needed an organization and we needed someone to speak for the industry. And before long, Greenpeace started attacking salmon aquaculture. And within 3 years of leaving Greenpeace, or even less, I was faced with the task of defending my new industry against attacks from Greenpeace, having been a Greenpeace international director for all those years. So that was kind of a switch. And so I got, that put me squarely back into politics of an environmental variety. Then I was appointed to the BC Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy, along with 32 other people in the province, and got really involved in sustainability issues. And then I joined the Forest Alliance of BC and lost half my friends. And when I joined the Forest Alliance of BC, it was for the purpose of helping the forest industry improve its environmental performance. My family has been in the forest industry for nearly 100 years in the coast of British Columbia. And I was well aware of the fact, as an environmentalist, the ecologist, having studied a lot of forestry, the head of my thesis committee in my PhD was Hamish Kimmins, who comes from this from the Yale School of Forestry, and then became a professor of forest ecology at UBC, one of the best in the world as a forest ecologist. And so I had a lot of some pretty serious mentors in the forest sector. And I knew that the forest industry needed to help to change its environmental practices, because it was still, like many industries in the 1980s, they were still doing things that we would never think of doing today. And so I joined the Forest Alliance for that purpose. In the process of becoming a consultant on environmental issues, I founded Green Spirit in 1991. So that would be 5 years after I left Greenpeace. And Green Spirit was founded in order to create a vehicle to develop an alternative environmental platform for sustainability that was based more on science and logic and less on sensationalism, misinformation, and fear, as I saw the agenda of much of the environmental movement and my old friends in Greenpeace going. And I had seen that when I left in 86. That's why I left. I left because they were starting to adopt policies that I could not justify or rationalize in terms of the science education that I had. I had a PhD in ecology, and most of the rest of my Greenpeace colleagues thought, oh, so what? We're all ecologists. Your PhD in ecology isn't particularly important, right? So it was never accepted that I actually had an actual education in the science of environment. There were a lot of people in Greenpeace who'd just been street people and dropouts and whatever prior to coming in, who saw themselves as being equally authoritative on the subject. So environmentalism, to me, started to lose its cachet in terms of the term environmentalism. The ism started to come to the fore.
Do you still consider yourself an environmentalist? Or
absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. It's just the ism part that bothers me. And environmentalism is a very different word than environmentalist, in the sense that the environmentalism implies that there's some sort of Bible or some sort of manifesto or some sort of litany of truths which are accepted by all, you know. And as an environmentalist, I don't think you have to accept environmentalism in that sense. The reason I joined the Forest Alliance was because, as I say, my family had been in it for 100 years. It had educated me, given me my PhD in ecology, and I had this 15 years of environmentalist experience, so I could bring something to the table. And yet it was perceived by Greenpeace and my other fellow environmentalists that this was a treasonous act to actually try to help the forest industry in any way, shape, or form, to associate with them in any way, shape, or form, was considered to be treasonous. And I thought, that's ridiculous, you guys. We need forestry. It's not as if we're going to stop using wood. We need to do it in a more environmentally acceptable way. And no, this wasn't good enough. People like Vicky Husband and my good friend Bob Hunter, who he actually disowned me twice during the period of our association, but I always got him back again. And in fact, he apologized to me before he died that he had been rather, intemperate in the way he treated me, because we should be able to have differences on policy without losing our friendships. But some people take it too seriously at that level, I guess. But so the reason I wanted to help was to actually help improve the forest practices in British Columbia. And the two things we did that were of importance during the time of the 10 years or so I was with the Forest Alliance is, number one, we convinced the forest industry to cooperate on the doubling of the parks and wilderness. And instead of being dragged kicking and screaming, to actually get in the process, and maybe they could help influence which areas were turned into parks and which areas were left for commercial forestry, and it might be in their best interest to do so. So we convinced them of that. So that sort of got that out of being a totally confrontational process. And the second thing we convinced them to do was to accept a government-legislated forest practices code, and not to be in some fairy tale world that the public would accept a voluntary code by the industry. And
but that worked so well on Wall Street.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, well, it worked all around.
Yeah.
It worked all around. It worked for everybody. It worked for the forest industry. It worked for the people of BC. It worked for the parks and wilderness doubling.
I was saying the voluntary codes.
Yeah, the involuntary code. Yeah, exactly. That worked so well on Wall Street. No, you need regulation, of course. The first forest practices code was way overly cumbersome and overburdened with minor points. In other words, it was a prescriptive rather than a results-oriented code, as they say now. And now the forest practice, you know, the pendulum moves maybe too far on the first swing, but when it came back to a bit more reasonable position. And now the forest practices code is simply taken for granted by everybody in the industry, and it's adhered to without question. And many things that were done in it were very, very good. There are still some things that have to do with minor changes in plans that have to go all the way back up to the top and come down again that are somewhat unreasonable, but it's never going to be perfect anyways. But we did a lot of good work, and we got the forest industry to accept that it needed to submit itself. You know, for the first years of this province, up until around the late 80s, the forest industry was king of the castle. Between the premier and the minister of forests, they could practically make any decision in the province because they had all the power, because it was the biggest industry and all of that. And it wasn't until the late 80s that the diversification of British Columbia's culture and economy started to occur, that it, you know, the forest industry either had to recognize that or be subject to strong censorship, because people didn't, you know, the forest industry at first reacted, well, we have to get a better public relations program then, you know. And what we said in the Forest Alliance, by the time they brought us in to try and solve a problem they couldn't solve with any of their existing institutions, government or industry, we said, look, it's not really what you're saying that people don't like, it's what you're doing, it's how you're doing this. They don't like what they see in the mountains, you know. You've either got to be able to explain why what you're doing in the mountains is right and okay, or you've got to change the way you do it, one or the other. And that was very effective, and by the end of it all, we now have a public in British Columbia who is reasonably satisfied with the way the forest industry is conducting their business, and we have a forest industry that, although in these economic times, is having a terrible time of it, it's a very cyclical industry, at the same time, we are producing wood for world markets, which is the most abundant renewable resource in the world, and we're doing it much more environmentally sustainable way than we were before.
Now, you said your family's been involved in forestry for 100 years. Can you talk about that? Explain how?
Yes, my grandfather Albert on my dad's side was from Ontario. The family originally came to Port Hope, Ontario from Ireland during the second wave of the potato famine in 1862. My great-great-great-great, I'm not sure how many greats there are there actually for sure, but it's quite a few, grandmother, with eight children and a widow. She's a widow from County Armagh in Northern Ireland, came to Port Hope with eight children by herself. And from there they spread out eventually to Manitoulin Island in Georgian Bay, near Georgian Bay in Lake Huron. And then they spread out all over North America. Some went to the States, some came west. Well, only my grandfather came this far west. Some went to Saskatoon as well. My grandfather Albert, who was a rail tie splitter at the Lakehead, what was then called Port Arthur, which is now Thunder Bay, he came west on the railroad, and he was eventually hired. He was somewhat educated, was eventually hired by the Whalen brothers, who were financiers from the U.S., who built the wood fiber pulp mill, the Port Alice pulp mill, and the defunct pulp mill at Swanson Bay near Butedale on the Inside Passage. It only lasted for about 10 years. But both Wood Fiber and Port Alice became long-running pulp and paper operations. Port Alice is still operating. I think Wood Fiber's been closed, if I remember correctly, but very recently. And he became the chief timber cruiser for those operations. And as those pulp mills were being constructed in the early part of the century, like beginning in around 1908, he was the person who led the team out to map the forest in order to prepare the plans for logging. So he was the first person ever on much of the West Coast here, on big areas of the West Coast, to actually do a cruise of the timber where you basically you show on a map what the timber type is over the whole area and also the terrain. So while they were doing the cruise, they were also doing terrain with the elevations. And so looking at the topography in a way that you could sort of figure out where roads might go and stuff like that. So he did that for quite a few years. And then in 1923, when he had finished that job on those three
pulp and paper concessions. They gave him, by this time it had become BC Pulp and Paper Limited, and they gave him a contract to become an independent contract logger in Quatsino Sound near Cole Harbour on northern Vancouver Island. And so he then had a crew of, you know, 15 or 20 people and a donkey and an A-frame and all the gear he needed to log. And he started logging there, and in 1938 he moved to Winter Harbour, which is where our family is still based, and began logging. They were just logging along the shoreline in those days in sheltered inlets in the fjords. And, you know, they did the same thing on Sproat Lake and Great Central Lake because they're big lakes with a lot of shoreline. And so my granddad, Albert, logged, and then they moved the float camp. Everything was on everything was on floats, which I was born on floats in Winter Harbour. And when I was born, the float camp was already had been moved in around 1942, was moved up to Awachalta Inlet, which is spelled A-H-W-H-A-O-L-T-A, Awachalta. And it's a beautiful, isolated little place, like for kayaking and stuff. There's nobody up there. Still to this day, there's no one lives anywhere near there. And that's where we were. I grew up there, and then the camp was eventually moved out to the to what we call the old camp now, and then was moved ashore in 1954. And so that's how I grew up, was up there. I came in just after the steam era was over and the diesel era had arrived, and also just after the crosscut saw and double-bitted axe era was over and the early chainsaws, which took two strong men to even lift and drag through the bush, was just come in then. And at the time I was a child, my father, my grandfather died of cancer in 42, just as the war was reaching its peak. And my dad, who had wanted to enlist, was not permitted to because forestry was designated as an essential industry. And so he was the boss and had to stay doing what he was doing. He inherited a business which was deeply in debt at the time in the middle of the war. And he also inherited 60 loggers, all of whom were older than he was, and managed to make that into a going concern by the early 60s. It took him all through the 40s and 50s to basically work himself out of debt and get on an even footing. And by the early 60s, he became somewhat successful. And by the mid-60s, he was president of the BC Truck Loggers Association, which he held for two terms. Eventually became president of the Pacific Logging Congress, which is the association of associations involved in forestry around the whole Pacific Rim, including New Zealand and Chile and countries, and was a very influential person inside the forest industry in BC. He founded the Loggers Sports at the PNE. He was the president of the Loggers Sports organization, which was called Festival of Forestry, and CanLog, those two education programs. He took people overseas to all the forestry countries. He took education students and forestry students from BC there, brought students from those countries here. He was really, really active in a whole bunch of programs, kind of ran his own company with one hand behind his back doing all these other programs. So he set quite an example in terms of public service. He was very much in favor of my initial involvement with Greenpeace. He, too, was opposed to U.S. hydrogen bomb testing in Alaska and was, in fact, our single largest donor for the first campaign of Greenpeace. By the time I left Greenpeace, of course, he was starting to dislike the rhetoric, especially the anti-forestry rhetoric that was coming out of the various organizations, and he was very defensive about that, of course, because he felt he did a good job. But he was kind of the old guard in that he thought his job was to cut trees down and make sure that new ones got planted, and that was sort of it. He didn't think much about biodiversity, and you know, neither did Jack Monroe like that word too much. That had to change, and a lot of the politics within the forest industry in the 90s in particular was simply about changing the whole mindset towards what it was that you were trying to do here. And whereas previously maximum timber growth and extraction on a sustained yield basis had been the primary objective. The primary objective has now become the maintenance of biological diversity, clean water, healthy soils, in the context of managing forests for large-scale timber production. I mean, we're not trying to do this with a Swiss Army knife. We are going to use, as one environmentalist lamented, high-speed chainsaws.
Now, we started off talking about environmentalism as a religion. When I was doing research before meeting you, one of the stories that caught my eye referred to you as Eco-Judas.
Right.
And what's your main heresy? What is considered your heresy to the environmental movement?
Well, the specific issue that caused Bob Hunter to coin the term Eco-Judas for me, and Bob was one of the most brilliant wordsmiths that ever existed.
So it was Bob who gave you the name?
It was Bob.
Okay.
He also said I was schlepping for the stump makers, which I thought was quite a good turn of phrase as well.
That is a good turn of phrase. Schlepping for the stump makers. Okay.
Yeah. It's better than, Rafe Mayer can barely get beyond shill. That's all he calls me, is a shill.
Okay.
And that's also some kind of Hebrew term, I would imagine.
Think so.
Schlepping certainly is.
Schlepping's Yiddish, but I don't know shill. I mean, I don't know the origin of shill. I know the word.
It just sounds like it is to me, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's something else. Bob Hunter was the one who coined the term, and it was purely and only with regard to my agreeing at Jack Monroe's invitation to join the Forest Alliance of BC as a director. And the reason I was invited by Jack Monroe is a number of reasons. First, he had been selected by the CEOs to chair the Forest Alliance as a way of showing solidarity with the working people who were going to be involved in whatever was going to happen as a result of this initiative. So that made sense to bring Jack in. Jack had never been the type of firebrand. I mean, he swore a lot and pounded his fist at the table, but he was not a snob. He would break bread with the management rather than treat them as if they were the enemy. He knew what his job was, and that was to get a better contract for his people. But he didn't regard the management of the forest industry as being some kind of evil force. And so that worked to bring him in. Also, Jack Monroe and my father, Bill Moore, were very close friends for many, many years. My dad was the first and at the time only small logger who was invited to sit on forest industrial relations, which is the bargaining arm of the management of the forest industry that would bargain directly with the IWA at the time, and now the steelworkers. So my dad and Jack Monroe had known each other for many, many years, and my dad was always very supportive of the union. As a matter of fact, in the late 1940s, when the union was forming in BC, when they were organizing in BC, he invited the union to his operation and said, I would like to be organized by you guys because I don't like the conditions that people are having to live in, and we're all in this together. I mean, he was only able to provide the same as other people were. So he supported the union coming in, as he was always a very strong humanitarian and a very close friend of the working people, and did a lot like Logger Sports. A lot of the reason he did that was to enhance the image of the logger as being something other than a drunk on Skid Row, but actually being a very talented person who could chop through a log faster than anybody could believe, that sort of thing. So he invited the union in, and Jack always respected him for that. So him and Jack were good friends, and Jack knew who I was. And I had at that time left Greenpeace 3-4 years earlier, and was now running a salmon farm on northern Vancouver Island, so I was I wasn't just a one-dimensional person. And they wanted some people with environmental credentials on this Forest Alliance, if for no other reason than to give it credibility, but also because they wanted some environmental people on it. And whereas Vicky Husband had been willing to join the BC Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy for a while, she managed to leave and embarrass it at the most opportune moment, which is their wont. But nobody in the strict sense of the environmental movement would accept an invitation to sit on the Forest Alliance board. Hamish Kimmins came and sat on it, and other academics in forestry did. But I was the only person with genuine environmental movement credentials that was willing to help the forest industry improve its environmental performance. Because the environmental movement saw the whole thing as if it was just a image PR exercise. Whereas it's very clear that if you look at the record, the practices in the forest industry changed dramatically through the 1990s to where they were nothing like they had been.
Where do you feel you've done more good for the environment, with your work at Greenpeace or with your work since Greenpeace?
Oh, I'd say that's pretty much of a wash in a sense. While I was with Greenpeace, we made some huge strides. I mean, first off, we stopped U.S. hydrogen bomb testing, along with a lot of other people, but we were kind of the sharp end of the stick on that one. The Save the Whales campaign, I would say that Greenpeace could take most of the credit for actually achieving that, because it was a two-fold approach. First, we were out on the oceans, which is where I was, confronting the whalers on the high seas and creating visual images that went through the world media and brought the campaign into everyone's living room. And secondly, we hired people like Michael McGonigal. I hired Michael McGonigal in 1976, realizing that we needed a presence at the International Whaling Commission on the diplomatic front, on the regulatory front, because that's where the rules were made. And so Michael began the process of Greenpeace's delegation to the IWC, and soon we were intervening at a very high level on that front as well and helping to change the politics. And by the time McTaggart came in to it in 78, by the time McTaggart came into it in 78 and started applying his Machiavellian political skills to overturning the whaling nations at the International Whaling Commission, we basically did it with a lot of rah-rah from all around, but basically Greenpeace won that one. And so those were the two main areas of, I would say, overwhelming victory. Then the small campaign that I'm most proud of is the campaign to stop larger supertankers from coming in through the Straits of Juan de Fuca to the oil refineries on the Washington state side. In 1981, the U.S. Coast Guard somehow got finagled into assisting the oil companies by agreeing to conduct a test of a larger supertanker full of water in broad daylight in the middle of the summer. Well, it wasn't the middle of summer. It was on broad daylight on a nice sunny day. And they were going to test to see if a big supertanker could come in safely. It was ridiculous. It wasn't a test. It was just a foot in the door. And so we said, we're going to stop that test. We're going to stop that tanker. And so we had a mothership, the Norsel, the most beautiful wooden boat in British Columbia, with my old friend, the fish farmer, sank and after he bought it with all his money that was lost eventually. Then the Norsel became our mothership and all our Zodiacs and helicopter news crews. It was a big scene out in the middle of the Straits of Juan de Fuca on a sunny January day. And we went in. I was always a Zodiac operator. Rex Weiler was the cameraman on my boat, and then we had a CTV news crew in another boat, and we had Mike Bailey must have had our cameraman or something, but we had a bunch of boats, and we came right in front of this supertanker, and Rex and I were right there with the supertanker's bow, like right behind us here, and we stopped that sucker. They stopped, and the Coast Guard was pissed. Well, no, I forgot part of the story. We said we would stop the test, right? This is like a month before the test. About 2 weeks before the test, the Coast Guard announced that they had promulgated a new regulation called the safety zone. They had created a 2,000-yard safety zone around the supertanker to protect the protesters from being hurt during the protest. Well, that was perfect. They had drawn a line in the sand for us. So now we knew what our job was. Go inside the safety zone, right? Defy it and commit civil disobedience. So we did that. They arrested us. They arrested me quite violently and put me in nasty handcuffs and took us to jail in Port Angeles. And that gave me a FBI record in the United States, but I never got, there was no charges, there was no trial, there was no conviction.
What we got cut off at was when we talked about what you were proudest of, and you were listing your accomplishments at Greenpeace, and then, excuse me, then we got cut off before you could list your accomplishments that you're proudest of. since Greenpeace?
Well, since I left Greenpeace, I'm proud of the fact that I was one of the founders and developers of the salmon aquaculture industry in British Columbia. I think it and aquaculture in general are very important. You may not know, but I simply reject the story that the fish farms are killing wild salmon. I do not believe that is true. I believe it is a fabrication.
So this would be why Rafe calls you a Sheldon, I suspect.
Precisely. That is probably why. He knows nothing of these things, in my estimation. I believe that the science around this is almost all David Suzuki Foundation funded with U.S. grant money. This money is politically motivated. There's a lot of forces in the United States who are opposed to salmon farming in B.C. because it interferes with the wild Alaskan salmon fishery, which is a very powerful lobby in Alaska, so powerful that it influences the positions of Murkowski and others up there at a federal and state level. So this is a big politic. Unfortunately, David Suzuki and Greenpeace end up saying that the best way to save the wild salmon is to kill and eat more of them in restaurants. And that does not make any sense to me, because 11 million salmon on average have been killed during the commercial catch in the years, in the 2000s, since 2000 till now. 11 million salmon are killed just when they're ready to go up the river and spawn, not when they're little, like these little pink salmon that are this long, but when they're fully matured and ready to go up the river, we're killing them. I do not understand this. And the sports fishery takes an equal amount, maybe, and the Aboriginal fishery takes another big slug of them. And so I'm not against fishing wild fish, but what I am against is the kind of hypocrisy that says, you know, I know some restaurateurs in this town, and the reason that farmed salmon is not on the menus of the best restaurants in Vancouver is because the David Suzuki Foundation has blackmailed the restaurant owners by going to sending people in there to say, you take farmed salmon off your menu or we will have pickets outside your restaurant. It's as simple as that. That is what has been done here in Vancouver, whereas restaurants in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles are happy to sell, to serve farmed salmon from British Columbia because it is a superior product. And in almost every case where there has been a contest between wild and farmed salmon by chefs in restaurants, the farmed salmon wins because it's consistent, it's tender, it's beautiful. I mean, that's what's a lot of, you look at what's being served in sushi and you'll find that it's farmed Atlantic salmon from BC in most cases. So I just, as I say, this so-called science of these sea lice killing all the baby fish, it's absolute BS. There is no truth to that story. And the statistics prove it. I mean, the highest run of pink salmon in the recorded history of the Broughton Archipelago was the year 2000, 14 years after the salmon farms came there. As a matter of fact, the average pink return in the Broughton has been higher since after the salmon farms came than it was before. That is, fish going up the river to spawn. That's DFO figures, and there's no lying. Now, in recent years, there's been a huge decline of wild salmon, not just on the Broughton, but also in the Fraser River, where salmon farms have no presence whatsoever, and in Alaska, where salmon farms have no presence whatsoever. So it's a little bit like the climate change issue, where, you know, 10 years ago, everybody, even myself, was becoming pretty well convinced that we were the cause of this rising temperatures going on in the world. But by 2008, 10 years later, the temperature has gone down, has not increased, and this year it's going to be quite a dramatic drop in global temperature. What does that tell you? And in addition, the sea lice story is a similar kind of story. It will not be many years from now until that thing is completely debunked and will be shown to be absolutely empty of any truth whatsoever. It simply isn't true. But even the salmon farming industry has had to react in a way that is like almost admitting guilt, because they were taking such a beating over it that they've had to join them rather than fight them. And that's okay. They're trying to survive. But on the science of it, no way. Even John Fraser, who initially was very supportive of
Alexander Morton?
Yes, Alex. who was very supportive of Alexander. His recent statements make it very clear that he is not convinced. Very clear. And so now they will distance themselves from him, of course. And he was appointed by the premier to lead up a special investigation of the science. They have not proclaimed on this as yet. They're still studying it. But the best scientists in DFO don't believe it either. You know, Biggs, not Biggs. I'm so bad with names. I meet so many people.
You're doing pretty well.
But he's an Order of Canada recipient with DFO, has been studying salmon all his life. He doesn't believe a word of it either. And the people who are putting this stuff out are like PhD students from the University of Alberta and stuff. And they're getting paid by Suzuki to do this. So I don't believe it. So that, I'm proud to have been part of the creation of salmon aquaculture in BC. I'm proud that I was a very active member of the BC Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy when we were able to do a lot around the communities of BC at a grassroots level to help people understand what sustainable development meant and how that was different from environmentalism and how it was different from just normal development, how it had a meaning to it. And so we helped put some flesh on the bones of the term sustainable development around the province. I'm proud of the work, I'm mostly proud of the work I did with the Forest Alliance, because that actually occupied the largest part of my time and effort since I left Greenpeace, which was to be the chair of the Forest Practices Committee of the Forest Alliance, to develop the principles of sustainable forestry, which are 21 points that I think if you look at today, stand up. I don't think I've got them on the wall here any bit. There's a round table piece of art there. The principles of sustainable forestry were signed off in public by all the CEOs of the Forest Alliance, which was basically 95% of the industry in BC, and they ended up having to report publicly on their performance. This was even before the regulations of the Forest Practices Code had been finalized. So we helped lead the way and get them ready for the fact that they were going to be audited, that they were going to be regulated really heavily. And I'm very particularly proud of the fact that I helped turn the forest industry around on the subject of doubling parks and wilderness. Because when the Forest Alliance came into being, the forest industry was generally against that idea because they saw it as a threat to their land base, which it was. It was a legitimate reaction on their part. But we helped turn that around, and very early on, we got the forest industry to say, okay, we support this, and we would like to help make it happen in a way that is less damaging to us than it might be otherwise. And more recently, I've been involved in so many things since then. I guess more recently, I'm proud of the fact that I have become an actor on the world stage on energy and climate, in particular supporting a combination of renewable energy such as hydroelectric, biomass, wind, with nuclear energy as the logical pathway to reduce fossil fuel consumption. Now, I know that's still not a very popular notion in British Columbia, but it's becoming more popular in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Ontario has already decided to build new nuclear power plants. This is happening all around the world, and I have just been awarded, the award ceremony will actually not occur till March, the National Award for Nuclear Science in the United States, which is based out of Albuquerque and is part of the Smithsonian satellite system. And it is actually the Einstein Society that is hosting me in Albuquerque to give me the National Award in Nuclear Science. It's in recognition of my educational role, because I'm not a nuclear scientist, but I'm certainly, ever since the first Greenpeace campaign against hydrogen bomb testing, on the way, on the boat, I read like this much books on the discovery of nuclear fission and the way in which it works, and so I'm very proficient in nuclear science, and that's why I can act as a fairly effective spokesperson for, you know, another one of the sort of logical inconsistencies of the movement today is that not only are they against nuclear energy, even though it is already providing much of the clean energy in the world that there is, most of the energy is being provided by fossil fuels, which are not clean. The environmental movement is also against the recycling of used nuclear fuel. Like, I thought we were supposed to be in favor of recycling stuff, and because of the energy, there's huge amounts of energy to be recaptured from the used fuel, which France is doing for years now, and which Japan has just started doing. And yet, for some reason, if you're an environmentalist, you're supposed to be against this form of recycling, even though you're supposed to be in favor of all other kinds of recycling.
Cool.
That's about the list.
If somebody put you in charge of our forest today, what would you do?
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, I don't know that I would do an awful lot different than is being done, because I was part of the process of changing the forest practices to what they are like now rather than what they were like before. I think I would certainly, as the government has kind of indicated, state that the park creation era is now over. That this the goalposts can't just keep moving forever. First they say they want 12%, then 15%, then 20%, then 30%, then 50%, then, you know, where does that end? It is okay in British Columbia to use the base of forest that has been now accepted, with the parks and wilderness having been created and more than doubled. We now have at least 15% of British Columbia in formal protection. But there's also about 60% of British Columbia's forest that is unsuitable for forestry, and therefore will never be used for forestry in any foreseeable future. And that is the high alpine forest, the too steep forest, the scrub forest of the West Coast, where it's just nothing but little wee short stunted trees in boggy landscapes. The thing that always upset me about this question of which areas do we preserve and which areas do we log is that the environmental community and the anti-forestry community generally seem to assume that the best areas for growing trees were also the most important areas to preserve for in perpetuity. In other words, there's no like compromise here. Whereas I know that in fact many of the areas that are not suitable for forestry are also extremely important from biodiversity point of view, and in many cases can preserve the values that exist on the areas that are useful for forestry. It's you know, forestry is like agriculture in the sense that you can't farm everywhere. You can only farm where it's suitable to farm, and that is usually flat places. And at least forestry can be done on landscapes that are hillier and steeper than you can usually do agriculture, unless you get into terracing and all that like they do in the tropics, but that wouldn't be particularly useful here. So I've always lamented the fact that this comes down always to such hardcore politics, when in fact there's plenty of opportunities to say, look, we've got this huge area here that is not suitable for forestry, that is quite capable of preserving these values. So let the forestry happen over here. But it's never been that way. And, you know, will the battles of Clackwit and the Great Bear Rainforest never end? I mean, is this an eternal struggle that will go on till the rest of time? I mean, surely at some point we could decide that the land use plan is suitable and sufficient for the time being, and that we have a system in place that will both allow a viable and sustainable forest industry and at the same time allow for the protection of those values in biology and ecology and biodiversity that we want to protect. So I would foster continued roundtable multi-stakeholder processes. It seems to me that we've kind of lost that. At this point, we don't have a lot of processes going on because a lot of it's been resolved. I mean, that's many of the jurisdictions in BC have been signed off. But Clackwit and the Great Bear Rainforest remain sort of ongoing sores in the dialogue about how we should actually manage the resources and zone the land. Because it all comes, in my estimation, it all comes down to land use planning and zonation. That in this area you can do this, this, and this, and in this area you can't do anything, and etc. And we need to finish resolving those subjects, is what I would say. That's what I would work on. As far as forest practices themselves go, I don't think there's a lot more to do there. I think we have done a very good job in BC of adopting world-class sustainable forestry methods and practices that will see our forest industry move into the future. There's always going to be natural events like the bark beetle and climate change, etc., that's going to interfere with our perfect idea of how things should be managed, because nature never, the only constant is change and all that sort of thing. Nature never operates exactly according to like a clock or anything. And so we're going to have to deal with the bumps and hiccups of the natural world, but at the same time, we have a large enough land base and we know how to grow trees, and we're doing forestry in a very natural way in British Columbia, more so than in almost anywhere else in the world. We are reforesting with native species and fostering a natural-like forest to come back in as the second growth or third growth forest. I mean, I love, on the way between Campbell River and Wass, but it's even closer than that. I think it's on the way between Campbell River and Kelsey Bay or Sayward. There is a third growth forest at the crossing of the Amour de Cosmos Creek. Amour de Cosmos, as you may know, was a premier of British Columbia, and there's a creek named after him. And if you look there now, you will see a third growth forest that is already, the second growth has been logged once again, and now the third growth forest is growing back. And you could never tell that from a young native forest. I mean, it is a young native forest, although there was planting done there. But then other species fill in by seed, and you end up with a forest that looks very natural.
How do you feel about trees?
I love trees. My only book I've written, the title is Trees Are the Answer. And I believe that trees are the answer to a lot of questions about our future on this earth, ranging from the most practical of what we should build our house with to the most aesthetic about how to make the world more beautiful and green. And in between that comes how to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. Trees are the most powerful carbon pump we know. And they are also the best solar panel that we have for producing energy and material. Trees provide wood, which is the most abundant renewable energy resource in the world, and also the most abundant building material in the world, as well as the byproduct of paper, which is used for printing, packaging, and sanitation. So the simple products of the forest are one of the most important for wide-ranging uses. Then there is the fostering of biodiversity, wildlife, etc. Growing forests is always better than planting farm crops, annual farm crops. If you want to have birds and animals in forests, on the landscape, grow forests. The other is cleaning the air, cleaning the water, and building healthy soils. There's nothing better to do that than trees. So the balance that needs to be struck is ranging all the way from the beauty of nature and the beauty of trees and forests, which is what your parks are for, wilderness parks are for, all the way through to the intensive management of forests for material production, while at the same time you're providing the benefit of nature conservation, biodiversity conservation, clean air, filtering the air, filtering the water, and building healthy soils. So trees are the answer.
Thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. For more on the future of our forests, be sure to look for my book, The Green Chain, Nothing is Ever Clear Cut. I'm Mark Larignan.